The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Global Development Podcast. I'm John Vidal, and this month we're looking at the jobs crisis and what impact that is having on development. This week, the International Labour Organization said that unemployment is now reaching crisis levels around the world, with 600 million jobs needed in the next 10 years just to maintain social cohesion. Their depressing report talked of 1 billion people now unemployed worldwide and young people bearing the brunt of the global slowdown. Well, nowhere is the issue more acute than in what's known as the Arab Spring countries, like Tunisia and Egypt. The revolutions there last year were largely sparked by youth protests against economic exclusion and unemployment. And across the region, unemployment is running at 27.1%. It's as high as 56% for young women in Egypt, and it's said to be rapidly rising in Tunisia. Joining me here in the studio today to debate these issues is Dr. Adam Hanier from the School of African Oriental Studies here in London, and Heike Harmgard, who's a senior economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development for the North Africa region. Later, we'll cross to Cairo to talk to Hania Shokalmi, a research professor at the American University. But let's hear first from Larry Elliott, The Guardian's economics editor. He's on his way to the World Economic Forum at Davos this week, where one of the things high on the agenda is jobs creation and economic growth.
The main message from the ILO is that the world faces a massive jobs challenge for two reasons. One is that there is a legacy of joblessness from the global recession of 2008-09. There are something like 200 million people who are without work, who want work, in the global economy at the moment. That's the first problem. And the second problem is that because there is a sort of young, growing population in the world, there are going to be something like 400 million new entrants into the labour market over the next 10 years. So that's the problem. The ILO says that, in short, the world needs to find 600 million jobs in the next 10 years. So far, there's been a lot of rhetoric and a lot of talk about what should be done about it. But in the end, the solution for this is that economies have to grow a bit faster. I mean, the reason that we've got a jobs crisis is because we've had a falling GDP in large parts of the world, which has actually affected demand for labour and affected the unemployment rate. So in the end, there's no real solution other than one which sees demand for labour going up.
Let's start with the global situation. So Heike, economic growth is clearly the way out, but where's it going to come from?
Recent crisis and how countries have recovered from them has shown is that the key driver of job creation and employment is actually the private sector. So yes, we have to look at government policies and how governments can improve the business environment. But I think the key drivers, we have to ask ourselves, why are companies not creating more jobs? And why are there a lot of graduate unemployed, in particular in the North Africa region, that don't find any adequate jobs in relation to their skills? So I think the key has to come from the private sector, and we have to ask ourselves, why is the private sector not creating these jobs? Is it because they don't have access to finance? Is it because they don't they face a lot of red tape? Is it because the competition authorities don't work and there's no level playing field?
Adam, that's a very sort of neoliberal way to see it. I mean, do you think that that's the case, or is it actually the governments really can produce these jobs, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think if we look at the reason for the jobs crisis, I think we have to look over the last few decades and the kinds of neoliberal policies we've seen implemented over the last few decades, things like policies of privatization, deregulation, the opening up of trade, etc. And the model that has been adopted and has become the mantra of private sector growth, I think, is actually false. The private sector is actually the problem, not the solution. We can see that, I think, very clearly in the Middle East and North Africa. And we can see it in the rest of the world as well. The fact that private sector and banks and so forth have been given a lot of money, and yet there hasn't been a recovery in the job sector. That money has been put into speculation and elsewhere.
Heike, how do you respond to that? I mean, he's saying that your recipe for job growth is actually the problem.
I think it's an interesting point, we have to look over the last decades. We also have to be looking closely at, so there's no one recipe for private sector growth. And I agree that if excess liquidity is just used for speculation instead of job creation and growth, that this is not the way forward to have sort of an inclusive growth model. But I do think that looking at how banks use the capital that they're given is actually an important way forward. So in that respect, I agree that one has to look at the financial sector specifically, and is the money that financial banks are using used for companies that want to expand, companies that want to hire people. So actually what we have found when traveling in the North African countries is that companies have repeatedly told us that why they cannot expand, why they cannot hire more people or invest in new equipment is that banks don't lend money to them. They don't access the risk properly. They don't look at their cash flow properly. So the banking sector, yes, has made a lot of mistakes, and I'm not here defending the private banking sector, but I think this is actually the vehicle that can help companies to grow, and I think we have to look closely how banks can fulfill this really important and crucial and core function.
So what's the real impact on young people in these economies? Have their hopes and dreams from last year's revolution been shattered? Mourad Tayeb talked to some young people in a cafe in Tunis this week.
Nasreen, do you think young people are right to be worried about their future?
Yes, I think that they are right to worry about their future because the percentage of the employed students is huge and they have a diploma and they are jobless.
Hossein, many people are contesting the performance of the government concerning employment in Tunisia. Do you think they are right, or should they be patient and give some time to the government?
Well, I think that being patient is something that we should not do, because we're expecting to be respected from the government to do everything, to prepare jobs and to do all the things that the people should do by themselves.
But the new investments promised by many companies in Europe, in the United States, in the Arab countries, they need time to be realized, don't you think so?
If we don't do something by ourselves, foreign help will not actually help. It's not the thing that we need for the moment.
Do you trust all these promises from many companies and countries to help the Tunisian economy? Do you trust that?
No, I don't believe in that, and I don't trust them.
Nasreen, a lot of young people, more and more young people, are looking to immigrate to Europe or to the United States or to the Arab countries. Do you think they are right to look for jobs outside Tunisia?
I think that in this time they should stay in Tunisia, because Tunisia needs their efforts. So, no, they should stay here and work here.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, Adam, does it make sense for young people in Tunisia or Egypt to go abroad? I mean, the irony is that youth seems pretty well educated in the Middle East compared with, say, sub-Saharan Africa. Why doesn't that match the needs of employment there?
I think the problems, as I've been saying, facing young people in the region need to be looked at over the last few decades. But the answers, I think, can be found in the region. Egypt is a very wealthy country. Tunisia, the region as a whole, is very wealthy. The problem is, what is happening with that wealth? Who controls it? Who has benefited from the last few decades, and who has suffered? And the other point I think we need to bring in here is the question of debt. In Egypt, for example, we have the government spending one-fifth of its budget on debt servicing. This is money that was accumulated by a dictatorship, what we call odious debt, and it's money, debt that should be cancelled across the North Africa region and Africa as abroad to allow these economies to actually grow properly and create the jobs that are needed.
What can you, as EBRD, what can you do in these countries? What can you do which is different and actually generate jobs?
Yeah, maybe a few words on the sort of what the EBRD is helpful here, because we are an institution that's financing the private sector. So over 70% of what we're doing is directed at companies that would otherwise not have access to finance. So we are not advising governments on what kind of policies to use, largely, and we are not looking at money given to governments for their budgets. So this is the new approach, and I think what we're looking at is the lessons that we have learned from Eastern Europe. And for example, if you look at Slovakia, Madeleine Albright was saying this is the black hole of Europe not so long ago, and sort of they have developed a very viable automotive industry. They have single-digit employment numbers. They have sustainable gone through the last crisis, and they are now looking like a very solid economy. So I think there are some lessons that can be learned from exactly why the EBRD was founded, namely to help countries that are transiting from a very state-controlled system and helping private sector to grow under these circumstances. And I think if you look at Egypt, yes, I agree that some of the reforms have happened, but state ownership is widespread in companies that are not necessarily most efficiently run.
Adam, do you welcome EBRD in places like Egypt and North Africa? Or are they just actually going to add to the problem?
Well, to be frank, I'm actually very concerned that the EBRD is entering these areas, because the record of the EBRD in Eastern Europe and elsewhere, I think, has come under a great deal of criticism, and particularly because EBRD's investments are very often linked to the promotion of PPPs, public-private partnerships, which is essentially a code word for privatization. So what has come with EBRD investments has been opening up things such as the water sector, wastewater, telecommunications, roads, and so forth, to private ownership, private investment. And what this means, because we know the private sector is seeking profits, it means an increase in prices, it means a deregulation. And these are kinds of policies that were implemented in Egypt. Egypt was praised by the World Bank and the IMF for implementing these policies. And these policies are the same policies that really are stimulated and underfed the revolution that we saw last year.
But Heike, surely he's got a point. I mean, we've seen water privatization and other privatizations in Latin America and elsewhere, which have led directly to revolutions in themselves. So how are you going to make sure that your input into these economies doesn't actually make a bad situation even worse?
So I have to disagree a bit that necessarily public-private partnerships is about private ownership of government utilities. It's also about just better management of some of these resources, wastewater, water, good examples, but also telecommunications. I think evidence has shown that not necessarily the government is a good way of managing telecommunications. If you look at most of these countries, telecommunications by entry of the private sector, rates have dramatically dropped, benefiting a large number of consumers now being able to afford telecommunication services that 10 years ago were outside their reach. So there's a huge efficiency gain to be done. But I think what I wanted to add here is that the EBRD is sort of a very much project demand-driven organization. So in this case, we are not imposing ourselves on any company, on any municipality, on any government, but more if there is a demand for assistance, for financing, or a demand for helping to construct a transparent process of how PPPs can be, for example, structured, then we can act. And I think what one has to look at also very carefully is not just about the headline words of these topics, but also how they have been implemented. And yes, I think Egypt has on the face of it implemented a number of the suggested reforms, but if you look at how in practice that has been done, this has been done in a non-transparent way. Specific groups have benefited from it, specific firms. It has left not very competitive sectors, and mainly this has also been because the regulatory agencies have not been very strong and have been very intertwined with the government.
Let's cross over to Cairo now, where Hania Shokalmi is a research professor at the American University. Hania, what is the situation in Egypt now? How bad is the job situation?
The job situation is much worse than it was even before the revolution, partly because the legacy of the pre-revolution era of poor education, poor skills development persists. But also there's been a total freeze on the economy, very little investment or no investment coming in. So it's really much, much worse than it was before.
We've been hearing arguments here for the private sector in Egypt to be liberalized and also for the state to renationalize some sectors. What's your solution to getting more jobs?
I think all of these sort of total solutions don't work, because And, you know, some privatization, sorry, were riddled with corruption. Others, nationalized industry was dismal. I mean, as a taxpayer in Egypt, I don't want to be paying for companies that produce, you know, products that no one wants, that are not competitive. I mean, the approach has to be a little bit more nuanced.
So are you arguing for more social protection for vulnerable people?
Yes, I am absolutely. I'm arguing for a basic income grant and for unemployment benefits and for minimum wages and for an openness and transparency, good governance, better laws, easier transactions.
But Hania, that sounds all very well, but where's the state going to get this money to protect its people?
Creating fiscal space for social protection is something that many other countries have done before. It needs a reprioritization of public expenditures using more transparent, more cost-effective methods of allocating these funds. I mean, basically moving to the means of a social democratic system where people are participants in overseeing this expenditure. Our current subsidy regime is so expensive over its overhead costs because of its leakages and so on, that any change in this current social protection regime would actually create a saving. And the other thing is that social protection does help people create jobs.
Tell me, Hania, if jobs are not found for the tens of millions of Egyptians who are looking for work at the moment, if nothing changes over the next 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, can you predict roughly what will happen? Are we going to see more strife? Are we going to see more revolutions and more people on the streets?
The problem is, John, that people who protested and people who are involved in labor disputes are people who have jobs. We haven't heard from the jobless yet, in fact. I mean, we've heard from them as youth. You see, Egypt is a perfect neoliberal economy, even if people don't want to accept that, because if of the 70% who are engaged in the informal economy, you know, they are taking commercial risks every day. They are trying to create jobs. They are trying to pursue their enterprises and ventures. So we need to make their life easier and enable them to access things like social protection, social savings, and so on, rather than pretend that the state will take care of everyone.
Hania Shockleby, thank you very much indeed. We've got a question here from Care International on our TalkPoint website. Should you target small companies or medium-sized companies? In other words, is there a role for microfinancing in this regeneration of a region?
Again, I think one needs to be very cautious about microfinance. And again, I think the evidence from around the world is actually pretty strong that microfinance is not necessarily the best way to go, because what it actually leads to is a deepening of indebtedness. It's a way of spreading loans and debt among the very poor, and often at quite exorbitant interest rates. And it's no accident, I think, that the largest banks have now entered the microfinance sector looking to make profits out of this. So I would, again, caution against seeing this as a strategy for creating jobs and getting out of the crisis we see.
Is EBRD into microfinancing as well?
So microfinance is definitely part of the menu that we can offer if there is demand. But I would agree, actually, that in terms, if you look at job creation alone, that the evidence has shown that small and medium-sized enterprises have actually more capacity to increase jobs and employment opportunities and more capacity to create higher value-added jobs that contain sort of more skills for the employment sector. So I think microfinance has its role, and I agree that debt sustainability there, again, is an important issue, and one has to look at outstanding debt, and it's not just by extending more and more, but by really looking at what can this micro business actually deal with, what is necessary for it to exist and grow. But for that, again, institutions are important. For example, credit bureaus and registration of these type of loans actually help to increase transparency and safeguard against some of the over-indebtedness that we have seen.
Can I ask you both about subsidies? I mean, Egypt and Tunisia are very, very well known for massive subsidies on basics, on foodstuffs, on water and things like that. And it's been a way of controlling populations. Are you Would you argue that these subsidies should be lifted? And if so, what should take their place?
I think that the subsidies can definitely be targeted much more effectively to actually achieve what they intend to achieve, namely to help the poor and target the ones that cannot afford otherwise to participate in economic life. But I do think the subsidies, and particularly the resource subsidy, energy, water, they have led to very resource-intensive usage across a range of sectors. And actually, that has also contributed to more capital and resource-intensive industries that are not very efficient in creating jobs. So I think actually readdressing and looking at these subsidies very carefully and decreasing subsidies for these very scarce, particularly as water resource, is an important point.
But Adam, as we've seen in Nigeria and other countries, you meddle with subsidies at your peril. I mean, there's surely in Egypt, if you were to take away food subsidies or water subsidies, you would have even more riots, wouldn't you?
Yes, I think the policy of reducing subsidies that's been promoted over the last few decades has been the wrong policy, in the sense that it is a wider question. But if we look back in, say, 1984 in Tunisia, there were bread riots when as an attempt to increase the price of bread by 100%. This, in as close as September 2010, the IMF was pushing the Tunisian government to lift further subsidies. And likewise, in Egypt, we've seen riots, demonstrations around the increase in basic food prices. So the problem is that there needs to be a way of securing food for the average person. Poor people, remember 40% of the Egyptian population lives in poverty, but the lifting of subsidy has gone hand in hand with also promoting export-oriented agriculture in these countries. So these countries are exporting food, but their people are starving.
Let's get this right. Are you arguing for a renationalization of farming and of other areas or sectors?
I think this is certainly something that needs to be looked at. One project, I think, which is very illustrative in this regard is 1997, 100,000 acres of land was privatized by the Egyptian government under Mubarak, and this project was praised by the World Bank and so forth. This is called the Toshka Agricultural Project. It was aimed to reclaim the desert. 100,000 acres was sold to a single investor. This is 1% of Egypt's entire agricultural land owned by a single investor, and this land was sold for $10 an acre. After the revolution, this deal was found to be illegitimate, and the investor, who happens to be a Saudi prince, returned 70,000 of these acres. But this is an example, I think, of how the policies of privatization enriched a few. They were promoted and praised by the international financial institutions, but they've had disastrous consequences for the average Egyptian.
Heike, would you accept that?
I think, again, we have to look closely how these policies were implemented and who was the beneficiary of the privatization. I think this cannot be, we cannot sort of draw conclusions from one illustrative example of a privatization gone wrong. For example, if you look at what was before the breadbasket of Europe, before the communist regimes took power in the Soviet Union, look at countries like Ukraine and Russia. Under a planned economy and government ownership, yields have declined to dramatically low levels. There's been an overuse of water, fertilizer, and the abundant resources that these countries have deteriorated under government management. And since then, actually, since the early 90s, especially Ukraine, but also Russia, has been able to increase productivity and has grown a number of mid-sized Ukrainian national companies that are producing grain at twice productivity that was prevalent before.
They are but able at least to feed under communism, everybody got fed.
I think if you look at poverty levels or income per head in countries like Ukraine, these have definitely positively evolved since the fall of the Iron Curtain. I think even on a poverty, if you only look at poverty and nutrition indicators, they have not deteriorated.
Heike and Adam, let's look forward now. We've got a slow-burning jobs crisis, which seems to be getting worse, not better. If this is not resolved either by the public sector or by the private sector, what happens in 5 years' time? What happens in 1 year's time? Do you see a new revolution turning up? I mean, how long will people put up with unemployment on this scale?
that's sort of obviously hard to predict. But I do think that if the private sector and governments don't find a way to, at least in the medium term, address these issues, that there will be a prolonged unrest in North Africa. I mean, it's very hard to say sort of how much will people put up with, or will there be daily strikes rather than weekly ones. I think this is sort of not the issue, but I think in terms of looking at actually increasing prosperity for the population in North Africa, these are the key issues to be addressed. I'm not sure whether decreasing unemployment to single digits will keep the people off the street, but I think this will contribute to a large extent to their well-being. And I think this should be the key priority, both of the public and the private sector.
Adam?
I mean, certainly the creation of jobs and getting rid of this horrendous unemployment problem is certainly the key issue, a key issue within the revolution. The question is how to do it. And I would say, again, looking at the historic debt that Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere in the Middle East owes to the West and Western banks is a good place to start. Looking at who benefited, where did the billions of dollars go, and looking at getting that money back and actually using it in a way that is democratically controlled to actually create jobs in a sustainable manner.
Well, there we have it. You've been listening to The Guardian's Global Development Podcast, focusing on unemployment, especially in North Africa. Thanks to Adam Hania and Heike Harmgard here in London and Hani Shokalmi in Cairo. And if you want to know more about global development, check out www.guardian.co.uk/global-development. This is John Vidal. Thank you very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.